It's not that hard to figure out if sin is sin. And just because a lightning bolt doesn't shoot down from the sky doesn't mean that God's okay with it. Here's Skip Heitzik to explain.
Every now and then I'll deal with a person who will rationalize God's non-resistance or the fact that he didn't tackle them in the midst of their sin as a sign of God's approval. I heard somebody tell me one time, well, you know, I prayed about divorcing my wife, and I prayed about this affair, saying, God, if you don't want me to do this, stop it. How utterly lame that is when God has already revealed his will in the Word.
Make the connection.
What must it have been like to know that everyone thought of you as the doubting one? I'm sure Thomas would have never imagined that his legacy as a disciple would forever be tainted by a moment of doubt. Yet that stigma has followed doubting Thomas throughout the centuries. To be fair, though, doubt is something we all struggle with, and even the great fathers of the faith suffered times of doubt. Skip Heitzik continues to explore how doubt helped shape Abraham's faith today here on The Connection. But before we go any further, I just wanted to remind you of an easy way to get free stuff. All you need to do to get a free copy of Skip's booklet, Radical Joy, is call and tell us it's the first time you've done that. Now, isn't that simple? We have a free booklet for everyone who contacts us for the first time. So if you've never done so before, give us a call at 1-800-922-1888 or write us at P.O. Box 95707, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87199. And if you do that for the first time today, we'll send you that free booklet from Skip. So how did Abraham avoid being called Doubting Abraham when Thomas couldn't? We may not be able to answer that, but if you stay with us, we'll see if we can find why Abraham was more known for his faith than his doubt, despite the fact that he had plenty of both. Stay tuned for more.
And make the connection.
Turn once again to Genesis chapter 12, and as you find your spot, we'll catch up with Skip Heitzik as he continues our study.
Well, he left the promised land. Let's go on. He lied, didn't he? He lied about his wife. He stops on the way there, and he has this little chat with her, and he butters her up. You know, you're really beautiful. Oh, thank you, honey. No, I mean, like, really beautiful. In fact, you're so beautiful that when we get into this land, they might kill me. So, here's my strategy. We'll lie. Now, keep in mind, this is the father of all those who believe. Mr. Faith. And his strategy is, let's just tell a lie. Well, it's sort of a lie. It's a half lie. Because actually, Sarah, according to chapter 20, is his half-sister. Half-sister. He married her, but they had different mothers, but the same father because of a subsequent marriage of the dad. They got married. So technically, she's the half-sister. So it's a half a truth, but a half a truth is also a half a lie. And this was certainly meant to deceive. Let me give you a little background of what's going on. Egyptians really liked Semitic women. In fact, they preferred their beauty over their own women because Egyptian men, and it's written in the ancient annals and papyri of Egypt, Egyptian men used to say that their own women faded too quickly. So there was a common royal practice among the dynasties of Egypt to just take a woman that you saw was beautiful, and if she's married, you can't commit adultery, so you kill the husband. And Abram knew this custom. Now, at this point, if you know your history and you know that Sarah is 65 years of age at this point, You're going, no, wait a minute. She's 65 years old and he's worried? Isn't that cool? 65 years old and she's still a knockout. And he knows it. And he's trying to cover his own bases. Actually, there are several ancient sources that talk about Sarah's beauty. Some of the ancient Arabic sources say that she got her beauty from Eve, to whom God gave a third of all the beauty, saying that Sarah had a perfect figure. In fact, there are some ancient stories, and they're probably just myths, but the myth is that she was so beautiful that Abram, in going to Egypt, put her in a chest, a box. I mean, she could breathe in the box, but carrying her in the box as if it were cargo, because she was so beautiful, she didn't want anybody to see. But at the border of Egypt, they forced him to open the box. They saw how beautiful she was, and they whisked her off to the Pharaoh. This is a beautiful gal. But his strategy is to lie. And here's the point here. One sin leads to another sin, doesn't it? Have you seen that? Doubt. He went from trust to doubt. Now from doubt to scheming. He went from doubt to scheming. I want you to notice something that is not in our text so far. There is no mention of God at all so far in the text. No mention that he's talking to God about the famine or that he asked for God's direction. There's no prayer going on. There is no worship. We know that he built an altar in Canaan, but he's leaving Canaan, and there's no record in the Bible of this guy ever praying, worshiping, or fellowshipping with God until he returns back. Now, I want you to notice that. I want you to go back to verse 8 and look at the end where it says that there he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. Then we have our story, and we already read it. Now look at chapter 13. Then Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot went with him to the south. Abram was very rich in livestock, silver, and gold. He went on his journey from the south as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place, the altar which he had made there at first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. He prayed at both ends of it, but not during it. He's left fellowship with God. He has left worship with God. He has left prayer to God. It's gone. It's past. This is something he's doing on his own. I had 4 years of Spanish, and I'm not really good at it. I just know little bits of words, and I can pronounce words good enough that people think, oh, you speak it, and I don't. But I do remember that there's an interesting linguistic problem in the Spanish language. It's with the word Lord. It's the same word as Mr. You would say Senor Smith, Senor Jones, and you would say Senor Jesus, Jesus. And you mean Lord. It's the same word. El Señor is the Lord. Now, it sounds like you're just saying Mr. Jesus, but you're saying Lord Jesus. We have the same problem in English. The problem is that we so often say master, but what we really mean is mister. We call him Lord, but we just say, well, he's a nice guy. He's not really my master enough that I would absolutely trust him implicitly through everything. That is a problem Abraham is dealing with. Well, let's go down to verse 15. That's the test, the failed examination. I draw your attention to two verses that are a false confirmation. The princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh. The woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. He treated Abram well for her sake. He had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female servants, male donkeys and camels. One of the things that happened to Abram when he got there and started going through his scheme is just how easily it flowed. It just seemed to be like, this is great. My little scheme is working. There's no resistance to it. There's no snags. In fact, maybe you would be tempted to think, this is a sign. This is a sign from God, because after all, if you're in the center of God's will, things just flow perfectly, right? No, they don't necessarily. I bring this up because every now and then I'll deal with a person who will rationalize God's non-resistance or the fact that he didn't tackle them in the midst of their sin as a sign of God's approval. I heard somebody tell me one time, well, you know, I prayed about divorcing my wife, and I prayed about this affair, saying, God, if you don't want me to do this, stop it. How utterly lame that is when God has already revealed his will in the Word. God isn't going to rearrange the universe to have the stars spell stop when you go outside. He's not going to hang 2 billion watt speakers from the moon going, hey, you, I see you, that's wrong. Yet some people take a flow, an ease, to mean God's hand must be upon it. Moreover, not only is there non-resistance, but he seems to be outwardly blessed, because there's the mention of all of these things, and the text would infer here that Pharaoh is giving to Abram more material goods in terms of servants and donkeys, animals, etc. So think about it. Wow, he gets to Egypt. Not only does the plan go according to his weird thinking, but the enemy is blessing him because of it. However, there are consequences. There are grave consequences, and we're going to see them in just a moment. I want to read to you something that F.B. Meyer wrote, an ancient commentator, but this sentence says it all. He says, the world may treat us well, but that will be a poor compensation for our losses. There is no altar in Egypt. There is no fellowship with God. There are no promises. So I guess you need to ask yourself, if you're tempted to go and trust back in the world again, is it really worth it? Is what you're gaining worth what you're losing because of it? Well, let's look at some of those repercussions, shall we? Verse 17. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now, therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way. So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. Question. Did Abram get away with it? No, he didn't. He didn't get away with it. He suffered repercussions. There's a proverb in Proverbs 16 that says, the lot is cast into the lap, but every decision is from the Lord. He's still sovereign. Or as Donald Gray Barnhouse used to reinterpret that verse, man throws the dice, but it's God who makes the spots come up. The spots come up in Abram's life here. And what are those repercussions? Well, number one, others were hurt by his sin. Think of it. He places his wife in jeopardy, as well as his servants and flocks and herds, and even Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. I remember in school, and you'll remember it too, an old axiom that says, every action brings an equal and opposite reaction. Now think about this. The disobedience of one dude caused all of these ramifications, all of these other people to be affected by his one sin. A runaway Christian is a menace to other people. A disobedient, doubting Christian is a menace to other people around him. You know, remember back to the beginning of chapter 12? God called this man to be a what? A blessing to others. I'm going to make you a blessing. And the world will be blessed because of you. That will come true, but right now, he's not bringing the blessing of God upon Egypt. He's bringing the judgment of God. He's become a curse. He's become a stench to Pharaoh. It's like Achan, who stole some money and some garments out of the camp and didn't dedicate them to the Lord. And because of that, all of Israel faced defeat at the town of Ai. Or David, who numbered the people so that he could boast in how many were in his army. And 70,000 people died because of his sin. Or Jonah, who got into a boat and thought, I'm running away from God, placing the entire ship and all of its people in jeopardy because of his sin. So others were hurt. Second thing that was a repercussion is that he is rebuked by an unbeliever. Did you hear this, Pharaoh? What have you done, man? Isn't this ironic? We're talking about Abram, the man of God, the man of faith, standing before a pagan king being rebuked by the pagan. Yeah, this is Abram, the guy that God made promises to, the guy that God said, this is your land, you and your descendants. It sometimes amazes me, but I believe that sometimes unbelievers have a better handle on how we ought to act than we do. Yeah, you see, unbelievers actually expect Christians to be honest, faithful, trustworthy, people of integrity. And the most painful thing is to watch a Christian on trial who has failed before the eyes of the world. How painful was it when Jimmy Swaggart was exposed on national television years ago by the media? In fact, it was really painful because it was one of Nightline's highest ratings as the world watched. Or when the amazing Randy on Johnny Carson exposed Peter Popoff as a fake, supposedly getting words of wisdom and words of knowledge, when actually there was a little speaker in his ear and somebody was feeding him information about people. You see, what Abram did in going to Egypt, he took off the pressure, he got food, etc., but it wasn't worth it. It wasn't worth it. Reader's Digest had a little story of a man and his wife at the mall, and they were walking through the store, and this man spots a young, beautiful, curvy woman, and he looks at her for a long period of time. And the wife said, "Now, let me ask you this question. Was it worth it for the trouble you're now in?" Here's Abram standing before Pharaoh being rebuked. Pause. Abram, question. Is it worth it for the trouble you're now in? Caused others to be hurt, was rebuked by an unbeliever, and I got to say his reputation was soiled. Number three. Look at verse 20. Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. Pharaoh sent him away, but can you imagine the conversation in the palace that evening? Can you believe that guy, this man of faith, this man of God, this guy who says he trusts in Yahweh? And what a bad reputation. Now, just to make things worse, he's going to do it again later on, the same kind of an episode, lying about his wife. And his son Isaac is going to do it too, like father, like son. So, a disobedient Christian doesn't help the lost because a disobedient Christian has lost his testimony. Remember Nathan to David? The prophet said to this king who had sinned morally, he said, "Oh yes, you're forgiven, David, but by doing this thing, you have made the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme or show utter contempt. David, you have just given a boatload of dirty laundry to the enemy who are already blaspheming us, but now you gave them ammunition." I talked to a man some years ago, said he was a Christian. I said, "Well, that's neat. I'm a Christian too." And as he started talking, he talked about that while he was a Christian, that he was involved in illegal activity. He got busted for it. He was angry that he got busted for it, and he was going to go to jail because of it. But he was trusting in the Lord. All this while claiming to be a Christian. I said, "Do me a favor, would you? Don't tell anybody you're a Christian. Until there is repentance in your life and you're following him in righteousness. Because all it's going to do is give everybody else a bad name. If doubting leads to disobeying, you become a curse to others, not a blessing. You lose your testimony. In fact, what some of us need perhaps is a warning label affixed to us. Warning, disobedient believer. Because they're very dangerous. Now, if you're taking notes, I want to give you three things to walk away with based on this. Just three quick little things and we'll close. Number one, if the promised land you're in, and I'm meaning your Christian life, is difficult, realize this. How else would you grow? How else could you grow? You're going to have tests, and like the dandelion story, try getting used to them. Don't expect to be immune from tests. You would never grow or be of any value. One of my favorite little illustrations is that if you took a $5 bar of steel and made it into horseshoes, it would now be worth $10. The same bar of steel, if you made it into sewing needles, would be worth $350. The same $5 bar of steel, if you made it into delicate springs for watches, would be valued at $250,000. But what beating and testing it must go through to get of that value. Number two, if your promised land is difficult, if where you're at tonight is difficult in following Christ, remain right where God has put you until God tells you to move. Stay there. I know you're tempted. You're tempted to get relief. You're thinking, I got to leave this marriage. I got to leave this job. I got to leave this town. You stay put until God shows you otherwise through his word or through some godly counsel. In Isaiah 28, verse 16, there is this promise. I lay in Zion a stone for a foundation, and whoever believes in him will not act hastily. Isn't that a great verse? Whoever believes in him will not act hastily, won't react. Or as the New Living puts it, whoever believes in him will never run away again. Number three, if the promised land you're in tonight is difficult, I want you to ask yourself a question. I don't want you to ask, how can I get out of this? I want you to ask yourself, what can I get out of this? What can I learn from it? What can I learn from it? Hudson Taylor, the great missionary, noted, God uses men who are weak and feeble enough to lean on him. Isn't that great? So the answer is lean on him. Oh, but it's too hard. Lean harder. And you stay put and cast that upon the Lord and go, okay, now, Lord, I have a problem and I'm making it your problem. It's yours. We have a problem here, Lord. I need provision and I'm trusting you. It's your move. You put God between you and your problem. Well, this chainsaw, I was looking at the box a little closer. There's some great words on it. It says, right up here, engine performance system. Great for firewood, great for tough jobs. It says on it, powerful, safer operation. There's a promise on this box that even in difficult circumstances, this unit will perform well. And so I want to say that God's promises mixed with your faith in those promises will make you powerful and safe even in the midst of difficult situations. God has made promises to you, folks. Don't underestimate them. Lean harder.
Well, I hope you'll take Skip's advice and lean on the promises of God. While it's true that circumstances can sometimes make a convincing case that such faith is foolhardy, as Christians, we shouldn't put our trust in what we see around us, but what lies unseen in the realms of God's love and grace. You know, this message could make a great gift for someone who could use a little encouragement at a time of doubt. So right after we tell you about this month's resource, I'll come back and tell you how to get a copy of today's study. First, though, the book of Revelation is a great one to study. But if it intimidates you, Skip Heitzig would like to help you explore the great treasures it contains.
When it comes to reading and studying the book of Revelation, here's the typical response.
Oh, no, not the book of Revelation. You got to stay out of that book. That's one of those closed books. That's for the theologians.
However, people often react that way to the final book of the Bible because they don't know what it's really about. So what is Revelation about?
It's not a bunch of analogies or a bunch of predictions of the future. Primarily, it is a singular revelation of a person, Jesus Christ. He's the center stage character in this book. He's the main subject.
If you want to know Jesus, you need to get to know him in the book of Revelation. Skip Heitzig wants to help you do that with his latest book, You Can Understand the Book of Revelation. Get your copy today for just $12 when you call 1-800-922-1888 or when you visit connectionradio.org.
And that's also how you can get in touch with us for a copy of today's teaching. It's available for just $6, which includes shipping, and you can order one or two or more when you call us at 1-800-922-1888. Or when you visit connectionradio.org. Plus, if you do contact us for the first time today, we'll also send you that free booklet from Skip called Radical Joy. So give us a call and make sure to mention if it's your first time to do so. Just call 1-800-922-1888 or write us at The Connection. That's P.O. Box 95707, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87199.
And make the connection.
Next time, as we learn how putting the life of Abraham under a microscope can really benefit us. The Connection is a presentation of Connection Communications, connecting you to God's never-changing truth in ever-changing times.